¿Llego directamente?
The attendance is gradually thinning down. I wonder why. Have you already started getting assignments from your other courses? Okay. So, given that you haven't yet got your assignment for this course, my forecast for February is pretty bad. I may be teaching to just maybe a handful of students, which is unfortunate. I might use my time in a better way, because you will have plenty of work to do for the computer networking assignment. So in any case, let's get started with what we have to do. Last time I was looking at the web and the HTTP protocol in particular, and we've seen various aspects of HTTP, like caching, cookies, and so forth, and including how the HTTP protocol functions and the messages and so forth. What we're going to do today is look at DNS and the peer-to-peer applications. Earlier I said that I was going to do socket programming ahead of peer-to-peer applications. But since we are running a little late in terms of the planned schedule, I thought I'll just go in the order given in the textbook. Okay. So last time I was hoping to cover DNS as well, in which case I would have done socket programming this time around. But since that didn't happen, we'll just go on in the order of the textbook. So DNS. What is DNS? DNS simply is a way to map host names, which we can easily remember, to IP addresses that are used for routing packets in the internet. Okay. So this is very much like having a mapping between your name and your passport number, or the name and the national insurance number, or any kind of identity, name and driving license number and so forth. So basically this kind of mapping is maintained in some database, and oftentimes you use that in real life for verifying that you are actually the person who you claim to be. Okay. In this case, the use is slightly different. The goal is to try and find out from a high-level username, a high-level host name, to an address that is relevant for routing. So since it is very hard for us to remember IP addresses, you'll see IP addresses are in a dotted notation where you may have something like 123.245.266.16. Okay. So those addresses are not very easy to remember. And in contrast, addresses like google.com or amazon.com or even ed.ac.uk, I think these are very easy for us to remember as humans. So we need a mapping. You type in an address name in a web browser, and you would need the system to tell you automatically what address to use and use that. Okay. So the way this database is maintained, so this is effectively a database, like I said, just like your passport information or national insurance information or driving license information. The address mapping information is maintained in a database. Because of the scale of the internet, this is maintained as a distributed database. Okay, so that's the key thing to remember. And the reason why we are studying this in the applications chapter is because it is an application layer protocol. Okay, so it sits in the application layer, but it is not an application that the users like you directly use typically. So if you are interested in trying to do this mapping, you can obviously use utilities like NSLookup and so forth to do this host to IP address mapping. But typically, this happens in the background. You as a user is not dealing with this. Okay? But nevertheless, it sits in the application layer, and it uses the transport layer services. So it becomes an application layer protocol. And it works on the end systems in the internet. So what does DNS do? One of the uses is this host to IP mapping, but it does a few other things as well. Okay. So the other thing that it does is it does what is called aliasing. So sometimes the actual name of a host may be too complicated for people to remember. Okay. So like for instance, some of the servers have very long prefixes, or they may have names which are just relevant internally for system administrators. So you would need a mapping between those actual names and the names that the outside world uses. So for instance, the google.com has something that is hard to remember in terms of even the high-level name, in terms of the actual name. And then you also have the address, the IP address it is mapped to. So in a way, this mapping is yet another layer of indirection, if you will, to make it easier for users to just deal with the simplest that they can use. But internally, you have multiple levels of mapping to get to the actual IP address. Okay, so that's host aliasing. We'll look at an example in a minute. So similarly, you will have mail server aliasing. So you have the web server and mail server, which are key services that you typically have to present to the outside world in terms of being available as services for people to contact you or use your content. Okay. So from that perspective, mail server information is maintained. Mail server host name to the IP address mapping is maintained in the DNS database. This load distribution use is very similar to what I have said last time around in terms of content distribution networks. So content distribution networks, I talked about them in the context of web caching as a managed way of pushing information closer to the user. In terms of how that is actually achieved, it uses DNS as part of the solution. Okay, we'll not go into the details of that, but in another form of doing a similar kind of benefit is to have your web server replicated and use a different IP address or different machine to deal with a web request each time you get a request. And this can be done by appropriately providing multiple IP addresses for the same web server in the DNS database. So what it does is it blindly does a round robin. Every time it returns a different IP address, and that will give you this automatic load distribution. So these are various examples in which, you know, you try to relieve your servers, actual physical servers, of a heavy load, and you sort of do this either by replicated content closer to the user or just at the server side, but, you know, you're trying to mirror the servers. So the distributed database looks like this. Okay, it's a hierarchical database, and at the top of the tree you have the root DNS servers, which are smaller in number, but they pretty much are maintained. They're always up, and in some ways, these are well known. So everyone knows, just like the port number for HTTP protocol, these are pretty much hard-coded, okay? They don't change very often. They pretty much hardly change. So these are the key parts in terms of making sure that the DNS ultimately functions, because, you know, rest of the servers can change in this hierarchy, but these are pretty much maintained as if, you know, they're always there. Okay, so that, you know, you have a constant set of reference. The next level of this are called the top-level domain name servers, or TLD servers, in short. So as you can see here, you have servers for the .com domain, you have servers for the .org domain, and .edu. And of course, you know, there are a lot many other types of domains. So basically, these are the top-level domains, like .net and .uk and so forth. Every country has their own top-level domain name servers. So these are managed by organizations which are accredited, and pretty much they are responsible for maintaining these particular top-level domain name servers. And at the third level, you have what is called the authoritative name servers. Okay. So for instance, if you take yahoo.com or amazon.com, they maintain servers within their premises, which are responsible for providing authoritative information about their servers, which the outside world needs to know. For instance, if you want to find out the IP address for www.amazon.com, then the definitive source for that information is this authoritative server that Amazon provides. Okay, pretty much the so essentially the actual source of the information lies with the provider. You know, that's another way to look at it. Now, if you want to do this mapping, then the process is you as a client will make a request to this sort of database, look at it as a cloud. And this, if you don't have any information about the top-level domain name servers or the authoritative name server for the website that you're trying to look for, then what you do is you will go and pick one of the hard-coded root name servers you will have on your host or in your local DNS server. And that will in turn sort of go through this hierarchy appropriately depending on what website you're looking for, and fetches you the IP address back. So that's how broadly this process works. So we'll go through two different ways in which the DNS search can be done, and the pros and cons in a minute, okay? So I've said about the root name servers already. You know, they are scattered in different parts of the world, but they're pretty much always there and well-known. This is also something that I mentioned. You have top-level domain and authoritative name servers. So there is another thing that is worth noting. Typically, whenever, as a client, or a host, we want to access the web, and we type in a URL like google.com, the thing that first happens is we do the underlying, the network infrastructure on the client side tries to do this mapping between google.com and the corresponding IP address. So that is done by placing a request to the local name server. Local name server may not reside on the host that you're using. For instance, it may not be on my, very likely it is not on my laptop and on my desktop. Typically, it is within the organization. For instance, here in the University of Edinburgh, each department has its own local DNS servers, sometimes multiple of them. And at the university level, you have a number of them. On the other hand, if you are looking at a residential access, then typically your ISP gives you a default name server to contact whenever you want to do this mapping. So this is part of your router configuration. Whenever you bring up your broadband router, you are provided this name server information. Okay, so that is what is the first point of contact into the database, although it doesn't actually figure in this hierarchy. So strictly speaking, the local name server may not have any place in this hierarchy because, you know, it is not maintaining a database to respond to others. It is purely acting as a client to reach out to the DNS database, so which can be limited to just these servers, these three levels of servers. Okay. Right. So given that, the question is, how do you resolve a host name to an IP address? So suppose that you are given a host like this, and you want to find out the corresponding IP address. So one way of doing this is to do what is called an iterated query. Okay, let's see how this works. So you are sitting at this host, and you're making this request to map this host name to the IP address. Then what you'll do is you'll go to your local DNS server. So this is what your underlying infrastructure does automatically for you. We'll see how this happens a little bit when we talk about socket programming, because, you know, there is something explicitly we try and do in terms of a call to the underlying transport layer. Now, so you ask the local DNS server this query to map this, do this mapping for you, and if it doesn't already have a cached information for this mapping, then it will go to the root name server, assuming that it doesn't have any other cached information. So imagine it's just starting from a virgin state where there's no information at all. Then the next step is the root name server knows that you have to contact the .edu top-level domain name servers, okay, in order to get to this particular host. Okay, so what the next step in the process is, this iterated query, by the way, is actually just going to supply this information of top-level domain name server to the local DNS server. Local DNS server is your proxy in this process. And once you get this top-level domain name server for this .edu domain, you contact that server to asking for it to give you the authoritative name server for this domain, cs.umass.edu. Okay, so that's the domain that you're looking at, and you want the authoritative name server for that. And you ask that query to the top-level domain name server for the edu domain. And in return, you will get this server's information, and then you contact that server, and this server maintains information about all hosts under its purview, and it responds with the IP address for this particular specific host that you're interested in. Okay, and then that is forwarded on to the client who actually initiated this request. So that's the final step. So the iteration is essentially happening via the local DNS server. So you have the first iteration through the root server, then the top-level domain name server, and the authoritative name server. So pretty much you're walking through this hierarchy that I showed a couple of slides ago. The recursive query tries to do this like a depth-first search. So you go through the local DNS server, and then it in turn delegates the responsibility of the proxying to the root server, and it in turn delegates the responsibility of proxying to the top-level domain name server on, for the domain that you're looking at, and then to the authoritative server, and then back. Okay, so this is like trying to do a depth-first search on the tree, as opposed to the breadth-first type search in the previous case. So the problem with this scenario is you involve the root server and the top-level domain name server a lot more, because, you know, they have to be part of this query resolution process until it is done. Okay, unlike in the previous picture, pretty much the root server's responsibility is to just give you the top level domain name server's name and address, and it can relieve itself to serve other requests. Whereas in this case, it has to be stay. It has to stay in the resolution process for a longer period of time, which means that the server load is much higher. Okay. So I sort of referred to caching a bit without actually defining what it is. So essentially, you do caching just like you cache web pages. The difference is you're caching a different type of information here and potentially for a longer period, because the hostname to IP address mapping doesn't change as often as web pages. So typically the caching time you have is in the order of 2 days. So in a sense, the root name servers are cached for an indefinite amount of time, because they don't change very often, hardly change. And then you have other cached information like the TLD servers and the authoritative servers that you have previously contacted. That information is maintained for in the order of several days, okay? So in terms of the actual database, let's peep into the database to see what it has. So it has, within the database, what are called the resource records. So they are the tuples which actually carry the information required to do this mapping process. So there are four types of records. You have a type A record, which actually is the main thing that we care about. So you have the host name to the IP address mapping. But the host name here may not be the host name that you typically understand it to be. So for instance, this particular host name that you're dealing with is only present in this particular authoritative server, okay? Whereas this is, so this becomes a host name in the other servers. So basically the host name here is broadly defined. It includes the servers as well, the servers in the DNS hierarchy as well. Okay, so that's the main mapping. And then you have what is called the name server mapping. So the name server mapping essentially says, if you have google.com, what is the corresponding name server? Okay, it doesn't have any IP address. The value in this case is actually the authoritative name server. Okay. So the authoritative name server could be something like xyz.foo.com, okay? And that might be the actual name server for the domain foo.com. And the canonical name, this is something that I mentioned previously in terms of the difference between the names that are made available to the outside world versus the actual names. So there's an example here, the www.ibm.com is actually this particular host name. But since it is not as easy to remember, you pretty much need yet another level of mapping, okay? So this is what people care about. This is how it actually gets translated. So basically, you will have an IP address mapping from server east.backup2.ibm.com to an IP address. Okay, so what you do is you do the canonical name mapping first and then a type A mapping next. Okay, so that's how you would resolve IBM.com. Okay, so while we're here, just let me walk you through this process. So let's say I want to go to IBM.com. Okay, then what I would do is I will walk through the hierarchy, the DNS hierarchy, to get to the authoritative name server for IBM.com. So that is provided by this NS record in the DNS hierarchy, basically for the .com domain TLD server. Okay, so that will maintain the IP address to this particular name server mapping. Then I will reach the authoritative name server for IBM.com. And at that point, if I want to resolve www.ibm.com, then the first thing that I have to do is do this CNAME mapping, because the actual host name that I need to look for is via this canonical name. So there is nothing like www.ibm.com, so it is actually this one. And then once I do this, I try to look for a type A record there, okay? And type A record for this would have the IP address for this particular host, and that is what is returned to the user side, okay? Is this clear so far? Yes? No? How many of you understand what's happening here? Okay, what about the rest of you? There are a few people probably didn't have breakfast. So, in terms of the protocols, I mean, I think every protocol that we deal with has a message format that we have to deal with. Sometimes it might seem very dry to go through message formats, but I think, you know, it is still instructive because, you know, you tend to find out very easily what kind of information is exchanged by the various entities participating in the protocol. So here, the DNS protocol has query reply messages, very much similar to the HTTP messages, except that here both of them have the same format. Okay, so in the HTTP protocol, they both are similar but not exactly the same. Here they're exactly the same, and except that, you know, some fields will be empty, you know, when you're dealing with a query, and the other way, others will be empty when you're dealing with a response. So here, the identification is basically trying to tag a query with a unique ID so that a query can be matched to a corresponding reply. So whenever you make a query and you get a reply, you want to be able to say which query does this reply correspond to. For that purposes, you have an identification and you have a bunch of flags, examples given here, whether there's a query or reply and so forth. And you basically, as a part of a query, you ask a bunch of questions. And the normal case, you'll just ask a question, like, what is the IP address for google.com? That is your question, okay? And in response to that, you will get an answer in the reply. This is from a client's perspective, okay? Like, when I make this request from my laptop, ultimately, this is what it looks like. But, you know, for the other queries that actually serve this original query, the message content changes. And then you also have additional information, like, for instance, this typically would be the mail server information when you ask for a web server. Because, you know, this is something that additionally provided, anticipating that you might use it or you might need it later on. And you also have this authoritative name server information so that you don't have to go to the top of the hierarchy next time around. Okay, so you directly go to google.com's authoritative name server instead of having to go to the root server and then the com TLD server next time. Okay, so basically it's like a shortcut into the database. Yeah, pretty much I covered that. the next issue is actually the most important issue, really. So basically we sort of assumed a lot of things so far by sort of thinking that, you know, these google.com addresses or everything actually somehow got into the database in the first place. But how did it get in the database? Okay, so this is like a distributed database, you know, spread out among a large number of servers. So how do you actually get your information into this distributed database, and how do you actually use it to resolve your names? So imagine that you sort of want to create a new domain, like networkutopia.com. We have done recently something called broadbandforall.net. Okay, so that information, when you first get this domain, you have to pay some fee to maintain that address, or basically block that domain for you. Okay, So basically, there is an annual fee that you pay to one of the registrars depending on the domain that you're interested in. So in the example that I said, the broadbandforall.net, you pay this to the .NET registrar, okay? And you also, as a part of this registration process, you have to supply your authoritative name server information, okay? So basically, you provide for this particular domain, what is the name server that the outside world should contact, okay? So the NS record, essentially, okay? And then also the IP address for that particular name server. So you say, this is my name server for this domain, the new domain that I'm creating, and this is the IP address for that particular name server, okay? So those are the information, that is the information that you will provide to the database, and that is actually stored in the TLD servers for that particular domain. If it is .com domain, then it'll go and get updated, get the all the TLD com domain servers updated with that information. So when someone tries to contact, that's not yet done. So basically, you pretty much updated the distributed database, the three-level hierarchy that we saw to start with. Now, your responsibility as the domain owner is to run an authoritative name server, okay? Pretty much, you create the third part of the hierarchy. You supplied this information to the registrar, which updates the TLD servers, but you have to run the authoritative name server with that particular information, basically at that IP address and with that name server name, okay? And once you have that, someone from the outside world, if they were to type in networkutopia.com, as in this example, then you pretty much go through the query resolution process that we've seen. So pretty much it allows you to resolve and get the IP address for this particular domain, okay? So basically the setup process for the queries to run is like what I just described. Okay, that's about the DNS. One other thing that I didn't mention when I'm talking about DNS is it uses the UDP protocol, basically the bare bones protocol, which doesn't provide reliability or congestion control or flow control or any of those, because it is assumed that the DNS query resolution is robust enough to be able to survive without the overhead of maintaining connections and so forth. Okay. So because if a query fails, then you sort of retry, or you typically get multiple replies and so forth. So peer-to-peer applications are a different type of applications from what we have seen so far, like the web and the DNS and FTP and email. All of them are what we call client-server applications. Peer-to-peer applications, like we discussed to start with, pretty much don't have any notion of a always-on server at a fixed IP address and so forth. So basically, everyone is coming and going. There is serving capability in every entity, which is referred to as a peer here. There is no client or a server. A peer is both a client and a server, depending on what it is doing. And so basically there is no notion of this server thing, just to repeat myself. So this peer-to-peer applications have come up in the last 10 years, okay, 10, 12 years. So they have sort of pretty much become so popular that today millions of users use Skype or BitTorrent or things like that. So all of these are peer-to-peer applications. Okay, for your generation, probably peer-to-peer applications seem like a class of applications that was always there. But they are fairly new if you look at in the context of history of networking. So what's special about them is they have this scaling ability, which doesn't require any infrastructure costs. Okay, so they can scale well without having to go through a cost of maintaining the server infrastructure or server farm infrastructure. So that is the key advantage of peer-to-peer architecture. So what we're going to look at is, we look at an example case that demonstrates this scaling benefit. And we'll also look at BitTorrent as an example of distributing files, an example P2P application. And we'll see a database which is maintained differently from the DNS database. So the DNS database is a hierarchical database that uses the structure of the name to resolve the IP address. Okay. So as you can see, if I want to resolve google.com name to an IP address, I will try to use the com first and then Google next and so forth. Okay. So that is how the structure of the name is used to map the corresponding value, which is the IP address in that case, and you have a hierarchical structure that corresponds to the structure of the name that you're trying to resolve. In the example that we're going to look at here, it could be arbitrary. There is no structure to the name at all. You can have a movie name or restaurant name or whatever. The name doesn't need any structure. You, all you need is basically you want to find out where the, that information is stored, for instance, in a network. And that is maintained in a database in a distributed way, and how you fetch that information in a scalable way is also part of our discussion here. So we use essentially the distributed hash tables. So that's something that I'll talk about. And then we'll briefly look at Skype as well, at least a couple of these features that Skype has, which are interesting from a peer-to-peer perspective. Okay. First question is, why is peer-to-peer more scalable than client-server? Okay, so for that, we construct an example, which is a reasonable example that demonstrates this benefit. So we have a scenario like this, where you have a server which owns a file to start with that has a size F, and the goal of this model is to have this file distributed to a set of nodes, set of n nodes, which are referred to as peers. Okay, so basically it's one-to-many communication. You want to do this as quickly as possible. Okay, so that's the goal. And in order to do that, if we follow this client-server approach, the server becomes a server in the client-server context, and each of these nodes become clients. So what they have to do is they have to request the server for the file, and then they get the file in return. So basically, everyone tries to do this independently n times. Okay, so for each node. And therefore, pretty much you can break this down easily as n client-server sessions. So the cost of doing this can be analyzed so that we have something to compare with the peer-to-peer case. Okay, so for that, we'll make some simplifying assumptions. The assumptions are that the network, the core of the network is pretty much abundantly over-provisioned so that it is a non-issue. So it doesn't contribute to any delay or congestion or anything like that. So pretty much it's as if you're zipping through this cloud without having any penalty in terms of the delay. So that's an assumption. And also another assumption we are making here is whatever you see in this picture is what is happening. So there's no other application which is going to interfere with our business. So we only have one business to do, and that is to distribute this file to n nodes. Okay. So under these assumptions, we can sort of analyze. And also one other thing in terms of the notation, so you have UI corresponding to the upload bandwidth of the peer UI, and DI corresponds to the download bandwidth of peer I. And U sub S is the upload bandwidth of the server. Okay, so this is a notation that we'll use. Okay. Now, if you look at serving a file to n nodes in the client-server context, the server has to supply this information to the core network at least n times. Because between a server to client session and server to another client session, there is no interaction because the clients do not talk to each other. So they talk only to the server. So if they both have to get the same file, then they have to talk to the server at least twice. If you have two clients and if you have n clients, they have to talk to the server n times. So therefore, you have this much amount of time that you will take at least. Okay. So that is F over U sub S is the time it takes for you to transfer the file into the network. And you have to do this n times. So basically, you incur at least that much time. And each client pretty much has to download that information. All right? So, and it is limited by the download speed it has. So it has to download a file of size F via a download speed of d sub I, which means f over d sub I is the minimum that a client has to deal with. And across all clients, you can say you have to deal with, you have to incur at least f over the minimum of all the download speeds, because you know that is going to take the longest period of time. So if you have a particular node with a very high download speed, that is not a bottleneck. So the one which has the least download speed takes the longest amount of time to download the file. So basically, that is also another term that comes into the distribution time in terms of a limiting factor. So when you club these two together, so you have one term that comes from the server side and the other term that I just said, in terms of trying to download the file for the most bottlenecked client. And whichever is the maximum of that, you at least have to incur that much amount of time to download this file for all your end nodes. So this is reasonably clear. What is not clear is you have an equal to sign here as opposed to greater than or equal to. So the equal to sign corresponds to a case where you construct a particular schedule in which you're going to do this transfer so that you know you pretty much meet this lower bound. But the lower bound is pretty much obvious based on what I just described in terms of how the client-server communication happens. So is that clear to everyone? Yes? How many yes? Sorry? Once again, okay. So you have a file of size F that you want to supply to n users. So in the client-server case, each client has to download this information directly from the server. So it doesn't have anyone else to speak with. So pretty much what the server has to do is, for each client, it has to transmit this file into the network, and then the client will download that information. So if you look at from a client's perspective, you have the time it takes for you to get into the network, and then the time it takes for you to download that information from the network. And then we assume that the network itself is zero delay. Okay, so that's sort of an assumption that we're dealing with right now. So for downloading this, for uploading this information into the network, you would need F over U sub S, because that is the amount of transmission time you take. And for the downloading part, you need F over D1 for the first client, F over D2 for the second client, and so forth. Now, if you sum up across all clients, from the server side, you are doing this for each client. So basically, you incur at least n times f over u sub s in terms of the total transfer time. Okay, that is something that you have to incur. And from the client's perspective, whoever is the most bottlenecked client, meaning whoever has the least download speed, they are going to take the longest to download the file. So basically, F over minimum of that becomes also a limiting factor. So the amount of time you take to download the file to all your nodes or peers is actually limited by both these two terms, whichever is the maximum, right? So the equal to signs comes when you actually carefully construct a schedule or the order in which you do these transfers such that you meet this lower bound, okay, under the assumption that your network is zero delay. Okay. Any other question? Okay. So as you can clearly see, if n is very large, pretty much this linearly increases with n. Okay. Now let's consider the peer-to-peer case. The peer-to-peer case essentially means that the clients can talk to each other. So they're not just dependent on the server. Now they can depend on other clients as well. Okay, so that's the key difference. So the server can just upload this file just once and then pretty much be done. It can leave it to the clients to help themselves. Okay, so based on that, you need at least that much time, F over U sub S time, to upload this file into the network, and then server's job is done. And now, pretty much you have, let's say, when you do that, you have a client that has downloaded this information. Now, the total upload capacity of the client network or the peer network now becomes the bottleneck, because in some ways, as you share this file with another peer, now the upload capacity doubles, because in some ways now you have two peers who have the file, and then they have to help the rest of the peers. So basically the upload capacity would be the sum total of the upload capacities of the two peers who have it. And then now you have another peer and another peer and so forth. So basically the total upload capacity is the sum total of all the peers' upload capacity. And also, obviously, you try to upload this file once into the network. So basically, this is the total upload capacity you have. Now, you have to, so this is the capacity that you are given, and then you have to download the amount of information that you have to upload is effectively N times F, because N nodes need to receive this information. So as a result, the amount of time that you have to incur is limited by NF over this upload capacity. So this is the maximum upload capacity that you can get, and this is the amount of information that you have to transfer, and you also have to transfer this file at least once from the server. Okay. So if you club these two together, you get what you have here. And this is basically like before. So if you look at here, from each client's perspective, you have to download that file. I mean, I think, you know, there is no way around it. Okay? So the only new thing that's happening here is you have this new upload capacity that has emerged. So previously, the server is burdened with the responsibility of serving every user. Now, you have other clients that join the business. So therefore, you know, they relieve the server. Now, if you try to look at this, it is still a function of n, and one can argue that, you know, this also grows linearly with n, but you also have the denominator, which is much bigger than u sub s, because, you know, you're looking at the sum total of all the upload capacities. So if this scales at the rate greater than or equal to n, pretty much n is irrelevant here. Okay, so let's see what happens when you plug in some numbers. So you have on the x-axis here the number of peers, okay, And on the y-axis, the minimum distribution time as given by the two expressions we have seen before. And we are trying to compare peer-to-peer case with the client server. Peer-to-peer is the blue one, and the client server is the black one. And to for this example, we have used some specific values to plug into those expressions. So we sort of assume that all the clients have the same upload rate, which is equal to U, and which means F over U, and also the F over U equals 1 hour. So that's something that we are assuming here. Okay, and this y-axis is in